As we're turning into Exodus chapter 1 is where we're going to begin. Some of you have been to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, where I would say is one of the creepiest rooms I have ever walked into in my entire life. It's dark, and the only thing that's really lit throughout this room are the bodies of 24 babies who died anywhere from 28 days all the way to 38 weeks. All these children died of natural causes, some kind of complication, and as you look, they were donated to the museum in order to help further the education of what life looks like. And here's the thing, if you've ever walked through this room, whether you're standing in front of the child that only made it to 28 days or the child that made it all the way to 38 weeks, every single one you see is a child. Nowhere do I look and say, well, this one is just a mass of tissue. This one here is just a fetus or just an embryo. That smallest child you look at and you see that baby. And I look and I say, how can anyone look through this display and not see the beautiful picture of life? I think that's why that room is so dark. I think there's some contemplation of our own lives and where we have come from as you walk through that display through the museum. And we live in this world that struggles to identify life, struggles to identify the true value of life. We are pretty quick to identify the value of our lives, but we're not always quick to extend that value to the lives of others. And whether you're talking about slavery or abortion or euthanasia or any of these subjects, it's not about, for instance, being anti-abortion. It's about being pro-life and allowing that to extend across all of who you are. Shane Claiborne in the book Still Evangelical said, being pro-life is not only about protecting the unborn, but also supporting folks after they're born. Caring about that person who's standing on the side of the road. You know what? And maybe you would give them money. And maybe they would just spend it on booze or drugs or whatever you imagine they're going to spend it on, but they are still a person. They are still a creation of God. They still have value, even as we struggle with how do I best reach that person? How do I best care for that person? We know that great commandment that Jesus shared, that we're to love God with our heart, soul, and mind. But the second is like it, that we would love our neighbor as we love ourselves. That motivation of how we have been made would motivate us to love others. And you cannot truly value people, and you cannot truly value life unless you truly value God. Only then can you really love in the way you've been built to love. Now, some people might say, well, I'm not a Christian, but I can still love people. Yeah, but you're talking about the kind of love that doesn't get to what God said in John 3:16. For God so loved, agape, proved it, sacrificed something to demonstrate that love. When my birth father decided he wanted to start having visitation rights with me because he now had to pay child support, I remember we had to go out on this really awkward outing. I was 13 years old or whatever, and I remember going to the mall and doing all this weird stuff with this guy I really didn't know, and we got back to my house, and he gave me a $100 bill and said, here, this is for you, but I'm not trying to buy your love. That's garbage. It's exactly what you're not demonstrating any real love to me. This demonstrates nothing to me. And so today we're going to see a clash of two viewpoints as we jump into Exodus chapter 1. We're going to see the viewpoint of the Jewish people who valued God and as a result valued life. And we're going to see the Egyptian people who had devalued God and as a result had devalued life. And our big point today, I think, is a simple one. Your view of God impacts your view of life. Just that simple. The way you view God impacts the way you look at life. When I became a Christian, I realized a lot of the things I thought needed to transition, needed to change. Before I became a Christian, I could give you every argument as to why evolution was true, but then one day I started reading the Bible and realized God told a different story, and that I had been working off just as much of a faith perspective as I do now. Except now, there's proof. So as we get into the book of Exodus, there's a little bit of background to give you. Some of you are super familiar with the book of Exodus. You're super familiar with how long it is, and you're wondering what decade this series is going to end. That's none of your business. It'll end when I'm done with it. But anyway, I love going through the book of Exodus. I would preach Old Testament passages all the time, and people might say, well, if you preach an Old Testament passage, when are you going to get to Jesus? Well, don't forget that Jesus began with Moses and the prophets, and he was able to share the gospel. So if you only have an Old Testament, you can still lead someone to Jesus. But this book, Exodus, it literally means a going out. It was written by Moses. He had kind of 40 years with nothing to do out in the desert. That's likely when this book was finally written and penned. And Exodus 1 actually begins with a recap of season 50 of Genesis, for those of you who just watch seasons of things and don't understand how chapters work. So season 50 of Genesis, you end it with Joseph, who had been sold by his brothers, and over a decade of just mistreatment, finally becomes essentially the vice president of Egypt. And while he's there, God uses him because God had been steadfast to Joseph. Even when he was in prison, Joseph was steadfast to God. And God uses Joseph to rescue people from a huge famine. Which people? The Jewish people? No, just anyone who needed rescued. The Jewish people were rescued. The Egyptian people were rescued. Many nations around them were rescued. They didn't just say, well, it's just about us. We'll make sure we're okay. No, his rescue extended to many others because he had a high view of God, which means he had a high view of life. And eventually you go from just Joseph's family, about 70 people, explode. And to the time that we get to here in Exodus 1, you got about 1 million Jewish people living in Egypt. They're kind of hard to miss. And so you get to Exodus 1 verse 8, and now we see where the problem begins. Now we see why the Jewish people have to go out, why they have to leave. Look at Exodus 1 8. Now there arose a new king, or another word for that is Pharaoh, over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So this new king not knowing Joseph, there's a couple reasons possible for this. Number one, he didn't study history, which is dumb because history is awesome. It's so much better than math or anything. But he didn't study history, or it means that he was unwilling to acknowledge someone who might have been a better leader than him. So he's got some sort of issue. He doesn't really care about Joseph, which is really amazing because Joseph was loved by the Pharaoh. In fact, I was watching a documentary recently about the archaeological evidence. They believe they have found Joseph's house in the city that the Bible says he lived in. Not really that shocking, but just super cool. And so we know that Joseph was a guy who was highly regarded, but this Pharaoh is going to disregard him. That's a word that's going to keep coming up. Joseph's story is one that regarded God and regarded life. And this Pharaoh is a story of disregarding God and disregarding life. Let's take a look now at the full story, verses 8 through 14, Exodus chapter 1. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. And in all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So you see this beginning idea that a disregard for God leads you to a disregard for life. And why were the Jewish people targeted? Is it because they had rebelled? No. Is it because there were some kind of food shortages? No. In fact, accounts seem to show that the Jewish people were living peacefully with the Egyptian people, which isn't necessarily a totally good thing because it's another indication that the Jewish people had once again kind of become more like the people they were living around. So they'd become very comfortable. But Pharaoh says, but what if? It's amazing how what ifs are used to just scare and terrorize people. Well, what if this happen? So he gives them this big what if. And so based on what they might do or might become, Pharaoh strikes. You see, twice this word is used ruthlessly. It's a word that means he intended to break them. In fact, you see this other word used. No longer does he want to categorize them as people or as Israelites or as Jews, but he wants to categorize and change them to slaves. He wants them to be defined as slaves. He wants them to be defined as something less than human. And we still see today, it was shocking to me this week as I prepared. I mean, I've been aware, but to really understand the plague of slavery in our world, and I see the comparisons. I see a Pharaoh and a land in Egypt that disregarded God and disregarded life, and I see a world today that disregards God, disregards life, and so it's not that surprising that we see this explosion in slavery. You may not be able to see this super well, but the red areas up here are the areas where slavery is most prevalent in our world. Our International Mission Board, the division of our denomination that is sending people overseas, says that today there are over 45 million people that are trapped in slavery. 45 million people are trapped in modern-day slavery. What does that look like? Modern-day slavery has a lot of different faces. It looks like forced labor. It looks like child labor. It looks like sex trafficking, forced marriage, debt bondage. 1 in 3 of those 45 million are children. Warlords are giving children guns and putting them at the front lines of their militias to be led to the slaughter. In Asia, every year, 1 million children are captured and led into a life of slavery. In Cambodia, half of those children are sold into slavery by someone they know, trying to make ends meet, trying to give someone a better life, being told, oh, we'll do something good for your child. We'll give them a better life. But that better life is a lie. And you say, how does someone do that to somebody else? How does someone treat a life with such disregard? Because they don't see them even as a human. They don't see them as important as themselves. What did Jesus say? To love others as we love ourselves. You see the image of God. You see the creation of God in yourself, and you extend it to that kid who's over there at the table eating by himself, or to that new employee who just doesn't seem to be clicking with everybody else and sometimes seems a little odd or weird, but you begin to love them and recognize that they are as valuable as you are. And there was probably a time in your life you needed someone to treat you like they were willing to treat themselves. Now, even though America might be in the green, meaning that it's an area where slavery is not as prevalent, that does not mean that slavery does not exist and happen in this country. A huge slavery ring was busted up in Minnesota, where children were being brought in for sex trafficking. We see the stories every year, the spike that happens at the Super Bowl, and the depravity that is on display. But an FBI agent said, as sad as that is, it's still a 365-day-a-year problem in America. Children are being sold. They're being sent to America, being told it's a better life for their children, but now their children live in a land of the free, but they are a slave. This happens. In fact, they warned, in America, this even happens to Americans, and that there are teenagers who are at risk. Maybe they've had a stint in juvenile hall. Maybe they're runaways. Maybe they have a tough home life. And here's how traffickers grab them. They go and they just care about them a little bit. They maybe buy them some clothes. They buy them some food. And then they say, you know what? I've done an awful lot for you. There's something that I think you should do to pay me back. And these young people who have now depended on this person feel trapped and feel stuck. You say, Heath, that's a lot of bad news. Is there anything I can do? Actually, there is. This FBI agent said, number one, be aware. Earlier this year, a young woman was rescued when someone realized that she was hanging out with a guy at a store and she did not seem comfortable. And so this adult decided to call the police and then found out that she had been abducted. At first going thinking this person was going to take care of her, but later realizing that wasn't the case. You can look for churches and organizations that are supporting the removal of people from trafficking. There are all sorts of organizations that are literally, as crazy as this sounds, buying people out of slavery. I mean, essentially making a transaction with the trafficker to buy them out and then give them job training to help these people find some kind of life. One woman said, "I would leave sex trafficking, but what am I going to list as my job experience for the last 10 years? I mean, you see the way people feel trapped. And so when you're giving, we are taking that money. It's going to our cooperative program. You are supporting missionaries that are dealing with this epidemic, even in our world. So you see this oppression. You see the Jewish people being pressed down upon. So, of course, they were crushed out of existence, right? No. Look what it says in verse 12. "The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad." Why did that happen? Because God had made a promise. These people were not just going to survive, they were going to thrive. And every nation in the world would be blessed because of one that would come from this line one day, that being Jesus Christ. So God kept his promises. So of course the Jewish people, as they multiplied, I'm sure were just so excited about their oppression because look how well it was working out for them. No, all it did was make a larger slave force. But now, even though they've been moved into slavery, the Pharaoh's going, okay, well, we've got all these slaves, but they're still going to overrun us. He's still worried about some threat coming. So the Egyptians' disregard for God is going to lead them to a further disregard for life, now striking at the most innocent. Take a look, verses 15 through 22. "So then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, 'When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live.' But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this and let the male children live?' The midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them.'" Just kind of funny. They're like, our women are just better than your women. Verse 20, "So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all the people." You see, at first he started with just the midwives. You do it. Now he goes to all the Egyptians and says, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." See, he decides he's going to strike at the very beginning. He's going to end these lives before they can even start. You know, you think about our nation and the number of lives that have been ended before they could even start. Last year, there was an interview that was going around on YouTube because it was partly, I mean, it was just sad. It was a woman. She is a professor at Princeton. Her name is Elizabeth Harmon. And she was having an interview about abortion and about the ethics of abortion. And here was her argument for why abortion is okay. She said, if a woman chooses to have an abortion, then the baby has no future and therefore no moral status as a person. But if a woman chooses to have the baby, then it is a person and has moral status as a person. So I want you to get this. This person who apparently gets paid money said this: if a woman doesn't want to have her baby, then it's not a person. But if she wants to have her baby, it's a person. Here's the problem. What about the woman who's back and forth? Well, I'm going to, I'm not going to. Does that child continue to come in and out of existence? No, it's this proof once again that truth is not this abstract thing. Truth is substantial. Either something is alive or it's not alive. Sesame Street taught me that. A flower, it grows, it's alive. You grow, you're alive. A rock, not alive. That's a real Sesame Street song. I almost sang it for you. I'm so tempted right now. That squirrel is running all over right now. But you see the ridiculousness of that. We understand what life is. The only thing that has happened as science has developed and research has gone forward is we now understand how early life truly starts. That at conception, you have a person. All the future. Regardless of what mom or dad is going to do, that is a person with a future. Just because you want to snuff that future out does not mean they are no longer a person. Michelle Wolf, who some consider to be a comedian, has a television show, and she recently had her celebration and salute to abortion. And in that show, she said this: some people say abortion is killing a baby. It's not. It's stopping a baby from happening. No, that's called abstinence. That's stopping a baby from happening. If you're not ready for a child, then you're not ready for a sexual relationship. That's simple. So just because you want to say this thing I can't see in here is not a person does not make it true. What is true is that life means something because life comes from a creator. But we live in a world, I mean, as much as the United States has missed this, we live in a world that's way ahead of us in disregarding life. And I'm fearful that we're going to continue to go down the path of the world. I read a story, came from last year. Here was the headline from CBS News: Iceland on the verge of eliminating Down syndrome. Iceland on the verge of eliminating Down syndrome. Here's the reality. In Iceland, when a mother gets a diagnosis that her child has Down syndrome, the abortion rate for those children is 100%. Three children were born in Iceland last year with Down syndrome because their moms didn't get the test. So the headline might say that they are eliminating Down syndrome. The reality is that they are bringing a holocaust against Down syndrome people. That is the reality. We can say one thing, but the truth is what is real. A church planter in Iceland said a lot of people say don't come to Iceland because 85% of people in Iceland say they're Lutheran, they're Christian, they're saved. And yet, statistics show that they are the sixth most atheistic nation in the world. Why? Because they say God, but they don't mean God. We have that in America, too. People all the time say, oh, 90% of people believe in God. 90% of people were on the phone and told someone, yeah, I believe in God, because they thought maybe their grandma had this person call them. That's the reality. So you look and you see a nation like Iceland. It's a place where there's actually a staggering dismissal of God. And because life is disregarded, you see other problems happening in that culture. Iceland is number one for children being born out of wedlock. And at the same time, it's number one in the consumption of antidepressants. And it's also a nation that has disregarded God and disregarded life. There are no coincidences there. There are only connections. But you see the rest of Europe, 98% in Denmark, 90% in the UK, all the way down to 67% in the US. It almost makes us look humane in comparison. And this was an ad in response to the earlier repeal this year of the Eighth Amendment in Ireland, which the Eighth Amendment said this: an unborn child has as much right to life as its mother. And Ireland said, we're going to get rid of that law. And now children are in great danger as a result. You say, well, they're unborn children. They're still children. Those are still lives. And when you have a low view of God, you have a low view of life. There's a woman, she's 30 years old, living in Iceland. She has Down syndrome. She was born at a time that they weren't having these kind of tests. And they went to her and said, what would you want to say to people? To people who think that this should continue on, that this is actually a good thing. She said, they need to see that I'm more than just Downs. I'm a person. She has a job, an apartment, a fiance. But people say, well, we need to eliminate that person because what is their quality of life going to be? Life matters. God not only works in the life of that person, but teaches so many others who have connection to that life how to have compassion. When I was growing up, I just don't remember a lot of special needs students in my classroom growing up because they always had their own class. Then I had a time of being a substitute teacher before we moved to Pennsylvania, and I was blown away that now those students were being put into the classroom, usually with someone to assist them. But here's what I saw. I saw the other students in the class show a lot more compassion to them than we had when they were separated from us. You know why? Because I believe it was shown, hey, these are people, and you could learn something from being around somebody like that. You could learn something from somebody who's going through great challenges but still has similar expectations on their life. You see that they have been created. You think you're important. It's time to start thinking other people are important too. It's time to start treating them like a creation of God. But when you have a low view of God, you have a low view of life. And Egypt was only valuing certain lives, which leads to devaluing truly all lives. That disregard for God is going to lead to a disregard for life. But on the flip side, a regard for God leads to a regard for life. Look at verse 17 again. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. That word fear again means to honor. It means to see God properly, that you are going to respond to God because of who he is. And they had a conviction that moved them to action. We cannot claim a position that we're not willing to stand for. We cannot say that we are pro-life or anti-abortion and not follow that up with our voice and our vote. I know we live in a messed up state. I know we have a lot of challenges, a lot of financial challenges, a lot of educational challenges, a lot of health challenges. Those are all important to me, but they're not as important as what an official says they will or will not do when it comes to the issue of life. And if you say that life is important, you better back it up by the bills you sign, because if you do not, you've lost my vote. It's important that we are people who say life matters. And yes, financial things are important. All these other things are important, but they are not more important than how we treat the most innocent, the most helpless. But also we have to do it with our voice. I had a boss that used to get so mad at me. I worked in an insurance company. My work was fine, but every year they wanted us to give to the United Way. And if you had 100% of the employees in your department give to United Way, you got some big party. I think Nikki remembers this. You get a big party. Well, I found out the United Way in our community gave money to Planned Parenthood. And so I didn't do it. And so every quarter, people would say, all right, we're going to get our party. And our boss would say, no, we don't have 100% participation. Thank goodness she didn't hang me out to dry. But one day she finally called me in her office and said, Heath, I tell you what, I understand you say that you can't give. Can I give in your name? And I said, no. If one penny, I recognize the United Way does more than give money to Planned Parenthood, but if one penny of what I give could lead to a child being endangered in the way I was endangered when my unwed mother was trying to decide if she was going to have me or not, I cannot do that in good conscience. I don't care what kind of party, I don't care what people think about me. I would rather they know that I'm not willing to. So we can have a discussion about why it's important. Last year, the United Way still gave $3 million across this country to Planned Parenthood. Last year. I don't care what good you do when you endanger life. What can you do? Support crisis pregnancy centers. We have them around here. Contact your representative. I email my representatives all the time. They send emails. I send them right back. Contact office. Say, I think you should do this. I think you shouldn't do that. You say, Heath, does it matter? Every time I talk to one, they say for every call or email they get, they presume there's 10 other people who agree with that position. Yes, it matters. If enough people would actually use their voice, it matters. That's the kind of government we have. Don't say, I'll just wait till I vote again. Annoy your representatives. Contact them. Tell them life matters. And in verse 20, it tells us these midwives, because they were responding, because they were not just saying that life is important, but they were showing it, that God dealt well with them. It brings up a question. Well, technically they were lying. Does God bless lying? Remember when Peter is brought before the authorities and they say, we're commanding you to no longer talk about this Jesus. So they're saying, here's the law and we're in charge. But Peter and the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than men. Does anyone wonder if the people who lied to hide Jews from the Nazis during the Holocaust were doing the work of God? I don't think so. We look and we see people who fear God. We must fight for life, not with violence, but with our vote and with our voice. a voice for the unborn, for the infirm, for the legal immigrant. Sometimes I get so frustrated when I see people deal poorly with the Korean people, especially those who don't have a strong command of English yet. And so you presume because they can't speak English like you do, they're dumb or they're stupid. That makes me so mad. They are a person. You see these people that are refugees, especially the more we get to know these young people and find out what they have come from. If you don't know what the Korean people have come from, sit down and talk to one. Even this year on mission trip, just as I thought I knew what they had endured, I realized I still am learning what they had to run from. And these midwives, because of their drive to protect life, preserved God's next leader. We see the foreshadowing of Moses that is coming. I believe a disregard for God and a disregard for life has robbed our nation of countless benefits. Who knows how many blessings we missed because we did not treat life with value. Your view of God impacts your view of life. Pete Wilson said, love God, love people, then repeat all day, every day. When you are loving God and you are devotionally serious, it makes you a person who is loving people. When we're talking about reaching upward, we're recognizing we're doing it, so we're better at reaching outward. We love God, and that motivates us to love others. Jesus put those commandments together for a reason, because he wanted us to be reminded it's not about, I need to quit lying. I need to quit getting so angry. No, it's about, I need to love God and love people. If you say, I lost my Bible, I don't know what I'm supposed to do anymore. Love God, love people, reach up and reach out, and you will hit it. You will hit that mark. And don't be angry at those who disregard God and disregard life, because lost people gonna lost. We need to respond not with anger, but with action. We don't stay quiet. We use our voice. We use our vote. We don't just say it's important. We express that importance every day. We help people see God because God saw them. God saw us. He saw our need, and he sent his son. When we love God, we mirror those midwives who feared God in the midst of a generation who didn't always give God his regard, his due. When we love people, we express through our witness that God cares about you. Do you realize that when you keep your mouth closed about Jesus, you are concealing the care of God that he has told us to share with other people? Do you see the opportunity that you have? Do you see that God sees you, that God created you? Let us kneel before the Lord, our God, our maker. He made you with a purpose. If you haven't recognized that that purpose includes giving your soul and your life to him, I'm telling you today, he created you for a purpose, and that purpose is not hell. God did not make anyone for hell. God created you with a purpose to honor him and to show love to people. My question to you today is, has God challenged you in any place that you need to be loving him more faithfully, that you need to be showing his care to others, and perhaps that maybe you need to finally acknowledge him as your maker and as your savior? Let's pray together.